Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're live in the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Greg Bluestein from the AJC is already into it. He is swinging and swaying to our theme music. Greg Bluestein does join us. He's a political reporter at the AJC. Thanks for being here, Greg.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course, Jim Galloway, who I think of as our wingman here on the show. He's the political writer for the AJC, is here today. You read his column every Thursday and Sunday in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he oversees the AJC Political Insider blog, which is online every day, all the time. Greg Bluestein, of course, a frequent contributor to that blog. Dr. Andra Gillespie, back from her travels. You were in Cleveland and Philadelphia. Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science. So as we get started, these were your first conventions?
Right.
And?
They were interesting experiences. I'm glad I had a chance to do them both. I was tired afterwards, but I'm very glad that I got a chance to do them both.
You probably were not quite as tired as this guy, Jim Galloway, who was just constantly filing stuff. You at least didn't have that responsibility.
I didn't. But yeah, I probably stayed out and partied a little too much.
All right. I may, at some point, we'll get your reactions to both conventions, because there are ways in which the reaction to the conventions is still lingering in terms of how voters are lining
right.
up. And we'll talk about that at some point. We're at Politics GPB. If you want to tweet us and join the conversation, we'd love to hear your feedback. I also, before we get started, want to thank you all for responding to our request that you let us know if you're interested in being part of this Political Rewind focus group that we're going to broadcast at the end of this month. We have gotten overwhelmed with people who want to be part of that, and we're sorting through all of those right now. We can only take 6-7 people, I think. So not everybody's going to be a part of it, but we are so grateful to you all. And you gave us great information about your interests in politics, and let us know in many ways how much you enjoy being part of this show as listeners. So thank you for that. We'll be announcing more about that show in the next couple of weeks. So Jim Galloway, let's start with Georgia and the presidential race. We learned this week that the Clinton campaign is now, partly because they saw the results of your poll, which show Hillary Clinton out front, AJC poll, which had it, I mean, the WSB poll, which had it pretty much a dead heat. There was another poll by an organization that I'm not familiar with.
Greg probably has the initials. I'm not quite familiar with it either.
JWB, I think it was.
Something like that. But the point is, there are a number of polls all of a sudden showing that this state appears to be a toss-up this week. Yes, that's what the polls are showing.
That's what the polls were showing, and we picked up word in the last, say, 24 hours from the Hillary Clinton campaign that they are going to quote invest, close quote, in Georgia. Now we didn't put a dollar figure to it. The Washington Post has got a little something up on it, and they put it at a 6-figure investment. And I'm a conservative when it comes to dollar figures, so I think that means $100,000,
yeah.
Which means maybe what, 2 or 3 warm bodies and an intern.
Yeah, you know.
I'm not going to say that they are that they are making a play for Georgia until I see a little bit more.
Well, and Greg, the other question that relates to what Jim is saying is whether or not the campaign did acknowledge they were going to come into Georgia. I think the timing was that Mayor Reed, Kasim Reed, a big Hillary Clinton supporter and somebody who's out working hard for her, after he went public and said they ought to invest in the state, he set a figure at about $10 million,
I think. He said up to $15 million is what it would take to turn Georgia blue, and also you know, set the stage for 2018, which he may or may not be a candidate for governor in 2 years hence. But this is the start of sort of what Democratic operatives described to me as a flirtation process with Georgia. It started last week with some scouting of Georgia. They're looking through the voter files. Next up would be polling. This investment is about 6 figures, as Jim said, and it probably is closer to the 100,000 figure. But if they like what they see, and they like when they go through the voter file and they start doing a little bit of initial polling, it could be bigger. But I'm with Jim. We believe it when we see, when we start seeing Hillary Clinton come visit, when we start seeing surrogates, when we start seeing ads. That's when this is truly about it.
Basically, this is building off our poll results that showed, I think, Hillary Clinton at 44, Donald Trump at
40.
30, at 40, and Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, at 12, and that's the important figure. And, you know, there are two ways you can go about getting Hillary. Hillary can go about winning Georgia in November. Number one, she can invest in Democratic voters, but she can also, you could also get a super PAC in here to start pumping up Gary Johnson and to split the Republican base. And it wouldn't surprise me if we actually saw that as we get closer.
And the last time a third party candidate got double digits in Georgia, a Democrat won, 1992. So,
Andra, do you think Georgia is turning blue?
I think it's turning blue this week. And so, so just because it's turning blue this week doesn't mean that it's going to be blue on November 8th when it counts. So, you know, I see the polls. I see that the recent polls are putting Clinton ahead statistically within the margin of error. Because remember, you got to double that margin of error in order for there to actually be a real lead there that I would actually be comfortable saying there. But I'm also not surprised by it. So there's the post-convention bump. There's the Donald Trump had a really, really, really bad week last week. And so that's also going to give Clinton a boost. I think the question comes now is, can the Trump campaign turn it around? And where is that equilibrium? And can we kind of go back to that? So I would say for now, if Democrats want this to be sustained, they're going to have to invest a lot into the state in order to cultivate voters, identify people in the next month and a half who can be able to register to vote, or 2 months, I guess, to be able to register to vote before we can say that this is the case. Now, I will say this. If this turns out to be a wave election, Reagan-Mondale-esque kind of thing, Georgia will likely be a part of that wave. But until we, you know, get more data, I don't think it's safe for us to say one way or the other.
Maybe you better explain what you mean by a wave election.
So a wave election is where you see kind of an overwhelming shift towards one candidate. So in a presidential election, I'm talking about an electoral college blowout.
Right.
So we go back to 84, where Ronald Reagan wins 49 of 50 states.
Right.
Yeah. You know, Georgia would be part of the 49.
It's not a change election, as we saw in 1994, when Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took over the House.
So
a wave election is quite different.
So a wave, I mean, we would talk about the wave if we were talking about in a congressional election sense, if you see dramatic shift from one partisan control to another party's control in the office, and them taking lots of people with them, kind of going into it. But here, what I'm talking about is a blowout in particular.
Okay. So let's go back, and I'm not sure, you know, one of you may be able to check me on this, maybe not. We know that no Democratic candidate for president has won Georgia since 1992, and Bill Clinton did. He did not win it in 1996, however. He lost to Bob Dole in 96. 2008, when you had Barack Obama and John McCain running against one another, it was a relatively close. Democrats came within, I think, 5 points of taking the state.
Yeah, I think it was Barack Obama got 47%. Am I right there?
Yeah, it's. I think that's correct.
Right.
So that's not a terribly wide. That suggested to me, when it happened back then, that there are opportunities for Democrats to succeed in this state.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we have to take into account in 2008 and 2012 that you have record turnout amongst African Americans who are overwhelmingly disposed to vote for President Obama in those races. So the question kind of becomes in this race, if I were advising Hillary Clinton, I wouldn't expect her to get 93 or 95 or 96% of the African-American vote. I would plan my models around her getting 90% of the African-American vote and then kind of shift accordingly.
Thank you, because that leads to the question I was going to ask you, Greg Bluestein. So Kasim Reed is now urging the Clinton campaign to invest $10 to $15 million here. Clearly, he's talking, among other things, about mobilizing the African-American vote. That's exactly what he tried to do in 2014 and expressed deep frustration afterwards when he did not think the state Democratic Party sunk enough money into get-out-the-vote efforts in the African-American community. And he blamed that effort for the loss of a Senate seat. The polls suggested Michelle Nunn might have won against David Perdue.
Yeah, remember, the polls in 14 were just as close as they look right now in 16. I mean, at this point, the AJC's poll also had Michelle Nunn in a neck-and-neck race against David Perdue, and looking like a runoff was going to be necessary. And you just hit on the big debate in 2014 between the Kasim Reed camp, which always talked about maximizing effort with minority voters, and the Jason Carter-Michelle Nunn camp, which was still talked about that, but also focused on attracting about at least a quarter of white voters who they saw as moderate, especially suburban moderate voters.
With an emphasis on television.
With an emphasis on television.
There was a lot of the dollars were a great part of that argument.
We know that Hispanic registration is up considerably in Georgia. I mean, I don't remember the exact numbers.
It's up 20%, but in terms of raw numbers, it's not that much.
It's still just a few percentage points of the overall electorate.
But there's another constituency that if Hispanic leaders can mobilize registration up until the deadline for registering, that could be helpful to a Democrat too. Yes.
So, yes, I'm all for GOTV, and I think it is a fool's errand
Get
to spend all of your money on television when you should actually be working on field operations, because that's what wins and loses elections. So I'm all in favor of this. However, I think it must be pointed out that in 2014, of the blacks who did show up to vote, and they turned out at rates comparable to their numbers in the population, the exit polls suggested that they voted, 90% plus Democratic. So it wasn't that the black people who didn't turn out to vote, who did turn out to vote, didn't vote Democratic the way that people would expect them to. The issue in 2014 was that whites didn't turn out and vote Democratic in the ways that they had been predicted. And so there were sampling issues with a lot of the polls going into it. Lots of polls, you'd see these fluctuations in terms of the number of blacks in the sample, and that would usually give the Democratic candidates a boost in polls. So first, we have to pay attention to how people are getting sampled and whether or not the demos are actually accurate, whether we're actually getting those. And then we still have to deal with Democrats need to figure out a way to speak to white voters in a way that's going to get them out to vote.
I think Michelle Nunn got, 23%? Is that what we said?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's not the white vote, and that's not the formula that works.
And right. The goal was pushing 30.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It was at least 25% is what they wanted, but pushing 30. So
right, and so you can't. So this is so it's not about minorities. I expect minorities are going to go overwhelmingly Democratic as they've done in the last few election cycles. It's a question of can whites be a part of that coalition?
The formula changes a little bit because this is an election year, and because you're talking about presidential politics.
Election,
and not that you're not talking about the U.S. Senate race. The winner in Georgia presidentially is the one who comes out with a plurality of votes. You don't have to get to 50%, the 50% mark.
Right, this is true. But I mean, and I don't disagree with you on that. But the fact that we couldn't even get this to, or Democrats couldn't get this to a runoff in 2014 is evidence of you've got a white outreach problem. So, yes, we want to, Democrats should, and Republicans should too, try to grow the electorate. But there's also sort of this issue of sort of recognizing where your numbers are and recognizing who your persuadables are.
You know, I'm fascinated by the way in which you turned that on its head a little bit, Andra, because we spend so much time in talking about elections wondering how the black vote is going to turn out, presumably for the Democrat. And you're telling us something entirely different, which is that the Democrats have a real problem with white voters in this state particularly. But given that, Greg Bluestein, do you happen to know off the top of your head? One of the tricky things when you're doing a poll in a state like Georgia is figuring out how to work your calculation of the actual number of people that you surveyed and extrapolate from that an entire population. And one of the real problems in this state is always, how do you weigh what you expect African American turnout to be? If you put it on the high end, it favors Democrats. If you bring it down lower, it tends to favor Republicans, right? Do you happen to know what happened in this one for you guys?
I don't know how we weighed it. I know that the African-American portion of the electorate is at least it's about a third right now of the electorate. And overall, minorities are pushing 40% of the Georgia's electorate. And I also know that the poll showed Trump abysmally low rates with African Americans. It was 2%, which is within the margin of error. So a statistically negligible amount of African American vote. And that's for a party where Leo Smith, who is on the air here a few weeks ago saying that he predicted Donald Trump would get 20% of minority vote around the nation. So there's a lot of work to do there.
Yeah, well, Leo's going to be a very busy man.
Yeah, he is.
I feel a free beer coming on.
Jim Galloway has a bet with Leo on this one.
But this actually raises a really interesting question about sampling, and not to sound too nerdy about this, but, you know, in 2014 in particular, a lot of the public polls that were available were unweighted polls, which is why you'd see these crazy variations that were going along. And so this was evidence of why you should weight polls. And so when I worked in polling, and I'll admit, you know, I worked for a Democratic pollster, you know, the method was you took what your raw numbers were and you kept a running average and you just weighted to your averages. Like, you know, there are things that certain polling firms can do to actually try to be as accurate as they possibly can be. It doesn't mean that you're going to get it right, but there is attempting to get it right, and then there is not trying at all and putting unweighted numbers up there, which are not representative, and you know they're not representative.
It was interesting, Bill. On Friday, we had Mark Roundtree here with Landmark Communications. He does the WSB polling here. And as we were walking out of the studio, we were talking about the AJC poll, where we had weighted the female vote at 53%. And he says, "Nah, I think you're underestimating that. He's putting that up." He said he would be more comfortable with that up near the 57% mark.
Really?
And which would, of course, help Hillary Clinton in Georgia.
Wow. Well, Mark had it as an even race, so I assume he weighted women at a higher percentage than you did, and yet it was a tie in his poll.
Right. So, yeah.
All right. So we started this with a conversation about how Hillary Clinton's people are moving into the state, in part because the polling looks good for them here. You point out, Jim and Greg, how little it appears the investment's going to be right now. Is it fair to say that what will really prove to us they're committed to Georgia is when we start seeing some TV ad buys, in addition, of course, to be nice to have a visit from the candidate. But they got to start buying TV if they really are going to try to win this.
You have to start seeing some TV. You really need to see some. I put a great deal of stock in radio, especially in Georgia.
I do too. How strange.
Well, I'm sorry. Commercial radio here. Commercial radio here.
Why do you say that?
Because it's an excellent and inexpensive way to communicate to especially to black voters throughout the state, reaching that black belt that stretches from Augusta to Columbus.
That is so true. That is something that we never quite pay enough attention to, is how candidates are buying on the black radio market. Although you probably do, because that's why you're so good.
And as you mentioned before, visits as well. Hillary Clinton hasn't been to Georgia since February. And there have been no real high-profile surrogate visits. We got word that Mike Pence is coming at the end of the month. But we still have no word from either the candidates or their top surrogates other than Pence actually coming here. So
let me throw one last thing out, and then let's take a break. Let me make a hypothesis that relates to polling and election day and see what you think about this. It strikes me that in an election like this, there in a state in Georgia, where we are so red, where such an overwhelming number of voters are Republicans, that when you walk into the polling booth with all the thoughts about, I don't want Trump, I really am sick of him, maybe, then there's Hillary and Gary Johnson. Do you end up going home just on instinct? Do you just end up saying, oh, my God, I can't not vote for a Republican? Is that hypothesis at all feasible in your mind, Andra?
So there's a faction of Never Trump. So those who are
routine
voters who are going in saying they're just not going to vote the top of the ticket and they'll vote the bottom of the ticket. I think probably if you make it to the polls on Election Day, chances are you're probably going to vote for something.
Yeah.
So I think the question is not so much you get to the polls and change your mind, but you just give up.
That's okay.
Before you even get there.
Right. Okay.
Right. And I would posit that those voters are likely to be older voters.
Yeah.
Because the third party option isn't in their DNA. They're not used to it. Whereas younger voters, which we've seen, are very willing to go Libertarian and vote Gary Johnson.
Okay, let's do this. Let's take our first break of the show. But if we can, I'd like to dig down into a few more of the questions that you all asked in the AJC poll. You rolled them out in the paper the first few days of this week, and I think you found out some really interesting things about attitudes of Georgians towards big issues in the race. But it's 2:26 on Wednesday afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Oh, noble sir.
On the next Fresh Air, Meryl Streep talks about learning to sing very badly. She stars in the new film Florence Foster Jenkins, set in the 1940s, based on the life of the New York socialite and heiress who performed arias and art songs totally off key and developed a following. Join us.
So fine.
Fresh Air is today at 3 on GPB.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Resolve to lose a few pounds this year? How about a few thousand? Donate your old car, truck, or RV. Drop a lot of unwanted weight from your garage and support public radio.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
Break it down.
Welcome back to the Wednesday afternoon political jam, Political Rewind, here on GPB Radio. I'm Bill Nigut. At the table today, Dr. Andra Gillespie of Emory University, Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Jim Galloway, AJC political writer. Can I do a quick round with you? Because I always forget. People always like to know how to tweet to you all. Greg?
Just my last name, Bluestein.
Okay.
At Bluestein, B-L-U-E-S-T-E-I-N.
At Political Insider, drop that last E.
Oh, yes, D-R,
right.
No E-R.
At Andra Gillespie.
Right, okay. It's nice to know. It's heartening that a guy as old as Jim Galloway is on Twitter,
yeah.
Isn't it?
I was the first one on Twitter.
Jim, you all had some really interesting findings about how Georgians stand on various issues that are important in this election. And here's one that I thought was really telling, and I'll leave either of you AJCers to pick up on this. But you asked a question about who the voter prefers, whose stance on immigration, who voters believe will be more trustworthy and can handle immigration matters the best. And Hillary Clinton has a 9-point edge over Donald Trump, yes?
Yeah, 51% to 42%. So that's well above that 4% margin of error. And we didn't ask directly about the wall on the Mexican border or the deport illegal immigrants or any of those questions, but it did suggest to us that more voters, particularly independents, a large chunk of independents said that Hillary Clinton had the better view on immigration.
And I'm guessing, and it's purely a guess, that you're seeing a big influence of rural Georgia.
Yeah, I wondered about it. Sure. People who rely on undocumented workers to get the crop gathered in South Georgia, yeah?
Yeah. Trump's polled best with voters over 65 and people from North Georgia, but Clinton won the day in the heavily agricultural southwest portion of the state and in metro Atlanta.
11% of Republicans, not a big number, but it's a number, of Republicans said they have more confidence in Hillary Clinton in dealing with immigration. Evangelicals, your poll found, overwhelmingly said Trump was their guy on immigration. Trump won about 3/4 of the voters in that group, and he polled well in people over 65, but Trump's polling well in voters over 65 in almost every category, right?
Yeah, no, so, you know, one of the things that I would have, and I know you have limited space to ask questions, is, you know, it would have been nice to have had multiple questions on immigration to see what aspects of immigration people are talking about. So, you know, Trump has proposed the wall, and then there's a question of feasibly, can you deport 11 million people? And then once you get past that, there still has to be a way to fix the system beyond that. Trump really hasn't said a whole lot about what he would do behind building a wall and deportations. Like, there has to be a way to kind of figure out what the nation's immigration policy would be. And so I would be curious in a future poll, if you have the space for it, to ask a second follow-up question about what aspects of
immigration. We've got one coming up in October.
Okay.
We'll write that down.
Okay.
Assault weapons. you all had some interesting findings again on assault weapons that, to some sort of extent, play against the grain of what I might have expected of, about Georgia voters. But your poll says that 48% of registered Georgia voters favor a ban on assault-style rifles. Now, 47% don't want that ban. That's pretty much a tie. But the fact that it's down the middle is interesting.
It's and that's not the first poll to show that. The what you have to remember is that ties don't matter in Georgia. What matters is what happens on the Republican side of that issue.
Explain what that means.
And that is in a Republican primary, that 47% against probably jumps up to maybe 70-80% against. And that's what rules.
Georgians are not opposed to the to having their fellow Georgians carry guns for self-defense. 57% said they approve of it. 51% of women said they approve of it, along with 64% of men. But under nearly 6 in 10 black voters who were polled here said they oppose or they don't like the idea of Georgians being able to carry weapons.
And I think that people, you know, may be responding to a number of issues. So if one lives in a community where gun violence is a particular problem, then you might be more supportive of some restrictions on when and where people can carry guns. This is not necessarily opposition to the Second Amendment. So nationally speaking, I can't think of any place where I would see blacks actually supporting not having the Second Amendment.
There have also been some small case studies that show that a black person involved in open carry and a white person involved in open carry are judged two different ways.
Absolutely.
Course,
and so I think some of it has to do with gun violence, and I think that some of it also has to do with just figuring out sort of common sense measures of sort of not how to restrict people's Second Amendment rights, but about how to do that responsibly. And so the idea of carrying it anywhere, not just for the you're more likely to get taken down by the cops, but just is a college campus the right place to carry a gun? Is a bar the right place to carry a gun? Should you really be packing in church kind of thing? And so there may be people who would support those types of restrictions.
By the time Andra gets done with the questions she wants to add to your poll, it is going to cost you so much money to conduct this poll. Every question costs money. You know that,
Andra.
All right. So immigration... Trump's strong stand on that. Virtual tie in Georgia as to whether people really think he's got the right approach to that. I'm sorry. Most people think he doesn't apparently have the right. They like what Clinton has to say about immigration. Assault weapons, pretty much a dead tie. But here's something that was really interesting. On trade, Donald Trump has made canceling NAFTA and TPP major showcase issues in his campaign. 72% of the people you surveyed said they favor trade agreements, and only 15% said they didn't. That is not a Donald Trump-like response, Greg.
No, it's not, and it came from across the board. It came from Republicans, it came from Democrats, it came from independents, it came from all corners of the state. And also in that same, the very next question was whether or not they supported a $15 minimum wage. And a majority of Georgia voters also said they support a $15 minimum wage, which is a real head scratcher.
This is Georgia does not have a Donald Trump economy. It does not. This is not a Rust Belt.
Yeah.
And this is an economy that had its domestic manufacturing wiped out. We lost all those textile jobs. We didn't want them back. We went for something bigger. We went for cars. We went for tech. And all of that is predicated on trade with the outside world.
All right. So one last question.
And not to mention the Savannah port, too, is completely
exactly.
Half the economy is built on the port.
Okay, so let's look at one last finding, and then I'd like to get your take on all of this. You asked in the poll for respondents to tell you about their vision of America. 39% told you that America's in the decline. 53% say, and it's your quote, the greatest nation. Once again, Donald Trump will make America great again. Hillary Clinton, we've always been great. We will continue to be great. So the voters don't go with Trump on that either.
So that's interesting. And I think that there are a number of things that can factor into it. So there are Democrats that are going to have a more positive view on it. There are people who are naturally probably more optimistic who want to have a more positive view on this. Keep in mind that the right direction, wrong track question is sort of typical of what we would expect, which is about 2/3 saying that we're off on the wrong track. But also, there have been national polls that suggest that minority voters, blacks and Latinos in particular, are more optimistic. And so that's also going to factor into that overall total result as well.
All right. So what all of those findings suggest to me, and Jim Galloway, I'll give you the first crack at this, is that when Georgians go to the poll in November, polls, they're not voting on Donald Trump and his stand on issues. They are essentially choosing between a Hillary Clinton, who they don't seem to like, and a Donald Trump, who they're willing to risk it with. But it's not going to be because they think he's got the right take on the issues that matter.
No, no. I think if it goes right now the way it goes, is look, this is, we are in a racially polarized era. I think it's going to follow that track. Old habits are hard to break. And I don't think, I don't see the economy driving things right now, which it should be after 8 years of a single presidency and a chance to change that. I just don't see the economy becoming that issue.
And another surprise on that same issue from the poll was that Georgia voters are basically split over the economy on which presidential candidate would do a better job handling the economy. Of course, the economy is Trump's strong suit. So the fact that Hillary Clinton is actually up there in competition with him says a lot.
But I do think this is going to be an identity election, and that's where I think that threat of optimism could make a difference. And we have to remember that also competing for these votes isn't just Donald Trump. It's people like Johnny Isaacson, who would benefit from that optimistic zeitgeist.
And who only has a 6-point lead in his poll against Jim Barksdale.
And has to pick up votes from people who are not going to vote for Trump.
Okay. We have gotten through more than a half an hour of this show without any conversation at all about Donald Trump's latest, what's the word? What adjective would you apply to the statement that he made last night?
Well, a gaffe is when a politician is caught telling the truth. So I would say that qualifies. But as far as the first 37 minutes of this show goes, I feel so clean.
When we come back, though, we really cannot escape talking about Donald Trump, the statement he made at a rally late yesterday afternoon in which he seemed to suggest, even in a joking way, that perhaps Second Amendment advocates could take up arms against Hillary Clinton. It's caused an enormous flap. It's had an impact on his effort on Monday at a speech in Detroit to reset his campaign. And we really do have to talk about it. We can't let the whole hour go. So what we'll do right now is take a break, take a deep breath, and come back and plunge back in to the heart of a very, very distressing presidential campaign.
A Syrian refugee cooks at the church that's helping her establish a life in this country.
When they eat Syrian food, they like it. They come back again to eat it.
The pastor, who leads an interfaith coalition, plans to welcome more refugees.
We have more congregations who are active in our coalition than we will have families arriving.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a safe harbor for refugees in New Jersey, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut here with Jim Galloway and Greg Bluestein of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Dr. Andre Gillespie of Emory University. I'm sure by now anybody who's following politics, and most of you who are listening to the show are real strong political fans, have heard the comment that Donald Trump made at a rally late yesterday. It was another one of those offhand kind of entertaining remarks that Donald Trump has become known for. We played it for you at the very top of the show. He suggested that Hillary Clinton will take away your rights to have a gun, but there is no recourse if she's elected. Well, maybe Second Amendment advocates will have some recourse. Was there a whole lot of question, Jim, about what he so supposedly was joking about?
He's become a Rorschach test. I think he kind of throws his language out there. And if you are of a certain mindset, you see one thing. If you are a certain mindset, you see another thing. Look, I mean, he was talking about a sitting president and what could be done to stop her. Let us say that the language was, at least as Jeff Sessions said, entirely awkward.
So it was funny. I had a little argument with my mother about this one yesterday. So when I brought it up with her and suggested that it may have been a thinly veiled threat against Hillary Clinton's life, she said that that was the media reading into stuff, and that's not what he said. So, like, don't twist what Donald Trump had to say. And so I think you're absolutely right that it's a Rorschach test. But what I was thinking of, especially how I'm going to talk to my students about this, is the notion of media framing. And so there are certain narratives that develop about candidates. And so since Donald Trump has the reputation for intemperate comments, that's how we could listen to that and hear, did he just threaten Hillary Clinton's life? So I think he's got to own that. And it's really funny, as a reality TV star, it's another reality TV star who said in the sort of things that you do after your season ends, that everything that's on tape, you got to own. So you either said it or you didn't say it. And if we caught it on tape, you said it. So you have to sort of live with the consequences of what it was that you said. I think Trump has to realize that he's got to live with the cumulative consequences of everything that he has said in the past 15 months.
At the RNC a few weeks ago, right after he finished up his big keynote speech, I went down to the floor and talked to a few Georgia delegates who said they were so excited because they didn't look at Trump the entire time. They looked at the teleprompter instead. And all they wanted to see was that he stuck to the teleprompter. And they were thrilled that he stayed on message the entire time. They didn't really even capture the speech. They were just so glad he stayed. And that's another example. After Monday, the campaign seemed so happy about his big economic pivot, his big Detroit message. And then you have yet another day where you've lost a day, you've lost maybe the week. Because instead, there's a tweet from a Georgia activist today who said, I'd love to hear the GOP discuss, you know, the Clinton emails today, but unfortunately, it'll defend Trump's comments instead. That's what's happening.
That's exactly right. Now, Trump has not backed away from, well, he's tried to explain what he
said. He said it was about a movement.
But what he has not done is to say, gee, I feel terrible if this was misinterpreted. And the campaign seemed to understand pretty quickly, whether they wanted to go there or not, that this was something that had to be cleaned up if possible. And so I'm guessing they very quickly arranged for Trump to appear on Sean Hannity's show last night. Let's listen to a little bit of how he explained it on Hannity.
Obviously, you're saying that there's a strong political movement within the Second Amendment, and if people mobilize and vote, they can stop Hillary from having this impact on the court, but that's not how the media is spinning it. What's your reaction to it?
Well, I just heard about that, and it was amazing because nobody in that room thought anything other than what you just said. This is a political movement. This is a strong, powerful movement, the Second Amendment. You know, Hillary wants to take your guns away. She wants to leave you unprotected in your home. This is a tremendous political movement. The NRA, as you know, endorsed me. They're terrific people, Wayne and Chris and all of the people over there. And there can be no other interpretation. Even reporters have told me. I mean, give me a break. But they're dishonest people. And I happen to think that if they actually did even bring this up, I think it's a good thing for me because it's going to tell people more about me with respect to the Second Amendment. Because Hillary Clinton wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. And if she puts Supreme Court justices on, she will decimate your Second Amendment.
Jim?
Well, Mr. Hannity served it up pretty well for him. but I got to say to the fact that nobody could have interpreted that remark any other way. I mean, the campaign came out within an hour of Trump's appearance with the secondary statement of what Trump actually meant.
Yeah. This is one of those moments, Andra, where I think maybe I'm wrong about this, but there's some ways in which it's like any politician or other public figure gets into trouble. The cover-up is worse than the crime. Mm-hmm. You don't have to necessarily well, let me just say it this way. If the more Trump kind of just talks and talks in the way that Hillary Clinton just talks and talks about her email, no matter how you feel about the issue, voters are not fooled by this, right?
Right. And I think both of them on both of those issues are should keep in mind that certain things are baked into the cake. So if Donald Trump says anything that could remotely be taken in or out of context, people are going to take it out of context and ascribe bad things to it. Hillary Clinton talks about her emails, and I was at that press conference on Friday. It was just contrived, and it was like, this is still not going away. You have not explained this away.
We're
going
to talk about that in just a minute, but I of all of the response I've heard today to this Trump comment, I got to tell you, nobody did it better than California Congressman Duncan Hunter.
You're treating Mr. Trump's words like he is the most articulate person who's ever graced our ears with his words. And that is not true. He is not a politician. He is not a person like you, who's very articulate, very well spoken. He's a business person who's running for president. So I don't think that the way that he said that and the sequence of his statements, I'm not going to judge him on that, because I don't think that's what he meant. And I think that he can be inarticulate at times. But so let's say that he was an English professor with a PhD in grammar, then I think that we could go through it this way and dissect what he said literally based off the sequence that he said it. But I'm not doing that with Mr. Trump, because you can't do that with Mr. Trump, right? I mean, he is a business person, and he misspeaks a lot because he doesn't speak for a living.
Greg Bluestein, if I need somebody to stand up for me, would you please make sure Duncan Hunter is not in the room?
Yeah, especially for someone. Words move markets. Words start wars, especially when you're a presidential candidate.
And no offense, he did kind of talk for a living. So if you ever did the Learning Annex or any of those other things, Donald Trump was a featured speaker.
Yeah, I don't think he did him a whole lot of good. No. All right, but then let's make this transition to what is a very important story that under any circumstance should have been the lead story across the cable news networks and the AJC and the New York Times played it up because they were the ones who did the story first. So we have a story that the Times ran this morning, which talks about some of the emails that were that the Clinton people did not turn over as part of the investigation. And the troubling thing about these emails is that they seem to show a very cozy and possibly inappropriate relationship between Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and the Clinton Foundation. They cite a couple of examples in which the State Department was approached about helping someone who was a big donor to the foundation.
Name redacted, of course.
Yeah, this is really, that's a big story, Jim.
We're talking about Dr. Gillespie's kind of fitting in the frame here. The biggest frame that fits both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton is the venality of their careers and its association with cold, hard cash. That you're right. This is a story that in any other construct would be dominating the airwaves today. And instead, well, look, if you're trying to diminish one sin, you put something bigger right next to it. And that's what's happened.
Right. I mean, and I think for this reason, Democrats just have to be prepared for the fact that Hillary Clinton's going to have a few bad weeks between now and Election Day. And her strategy is to basically say, well, at least I'm not this other guy. And she's got to become comfortable with, at least I'm not this other guy. But on her end, she's going to have to, instead of trying to explain things away, she's going to have to admit some misdeeds somewhere and then hope that the electorate is actually forgiving of those, because the other options don't appear to be as viable.
And if it was Clinton's campaign that actually leaked the news, which you never know, good timing. Because they leaked it at the right time.
Oh, I see. You're suggesting that they put it out.
If they knew it was coming out anyway, they might as well get it out.
You are a very devious guy, Bluestein. What should voters take from this, Andra, the cozy relationship between state and the foundation?
I think collectively speaking, between the emails and between the relationship with the Clinton Foundation, Hillary Clinton is going to have to own the fact that, one, she looks instrumental most of the time, and that's a turnoff to a lot of people. And then she also has to accept the fact that there are always going to be people who question her ethics, people who question her motives. And she also has to own the fact that she, in biblical terms, didn't abstain from the appearance of evil, even if things actually technically might have been legal. and that that's a problem for her, and that's always going to be a problem with her being able to establish trust with
you know,
with
it's really interesting. You know, Donald's got this habit of that of speaking off the cuff that he's got to control. Hillary's got this habit of speaking and thinking like a lawyer.
Yeah.
That just turns voters just inside out.
Yeah, you said you were at that news conference on Friday, and to set this up, remember you'll all remember that a week ago Hillary Clinton was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, asked to explain what Jim Comey said about the emails, essentially, and she said, "Well, he said everything I did. I told the truth." And in fact, she apparently did. Comey does confirm that they believe she told the truth in her interview with FBI. But when Comey had to testify in a House committee on this, he was very clear that she did not tell the truth when it came to statements she had made in the public eye about her emails. And so she was trapped after having made those remarks. In her news conference on Friday, once again, trying to explain, talk about having to know grammar. Trying to follow a sentence in what she said was virtually impossible.
So I was live tweeting in the middle of it, so there are times when I admit I might not have been paying a whole lot of attention to it, but I just thought she was trying to contort herself into this weird pretzel, and I was like, this isn't going away. And I find this answer really, really unsatisfying. She did slip in there, you know, if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't have done it. This is one of those where, look, you just gotta own, I screwed up, I learned my lesson.
Yeah, short-circuited.
I'm not gonna do it again. And when
short-circuited wasn't
thing,
the word, no.
Yeah,
no,
I mean, and so what she you know, basically what Comey was saying was we couldn't catch her in official testimony saying something that we could bust her on. And so she's lucky in that. And so she's able to fight another day. Now I think what people want to hear is some contrition and what she and her staff plan on doing better to preserve national security. And that didn't come through in that press conference at all.
Yeah. I don't think I've said this when I introduced this segment about the latest revelations. This was Judicial Watch, which is a very conservative group, which brought these emails to light because they got a federal judge to agree with their suit demanding release of these emails. And it's especially damaging because these were emails that, for whatever reason, the Clinton folks didn't hand over to state or FBI. So that's even more trouble in regard to this.
Right, right. We're only lucky that Russian hackers didn't
hand
them over to us.
All right.
There's still time.
we're gonna close out this discussion about Trump-Clinton in terms of the back and forth this week. You mentioned short-circuited. That's what Clinton said in her news conference on Friday. I short-circuited. We were talking past each other, Chris and I. Well, Donald Trump didn't take long to jump on it. And Andra, we're going to listen to this, but, you know, sometimes people aren't giving Donald Trump enough credit for how clever he is, how smart he is about a media message. And I think this, as he characterizes Hillary Clinton, is a perfect example of that.
She's really pretty close to unhinged, and you've seen it. You've seen it a couple of times, but people in the background know it. The people that know her know it, and she's like an unbalanced person.
Honestly, I don't think she's all there. She took a little short circuit in the brain, but I think that the people of this country don't want somebody that's going to short circuit up here, okay? Not as your president.
So the reason I say this is so smart is he turns around on her the kinds of words that have been used recently to describe him. Now, I don't know that anybody's buying it, but it does tell us something about how clever he is.
Well, I mean, so it's his own sort of interesting triangulation to sort of borrow from her husband's sort of policy playbook. I'm not sure that that worked there in that situation, but in general, Donald Trump doesn't apologize for things. He kind of sticks to his guns. He attacks the media because he knows that that will actually garner support and reinforce his support. So I think that's also part of the reason why, with the whole Second Amendment thing, he's taken the strategy that he has taken there. Also, just having seen it live and in person, Donald Trump has been known to exaggerate, and people tend to kind of let him get away with stuff. So he'll inflate attendance numbers and other kinds of things. So he's allowed to create his kind of of alternate reality, and there are people who are willing to go with him on this, either because they want an outsider that badly or because they really can't stand Hillary Clinton all that much. And so I think the question that voters have to ask is whether or not the ends justify the means, and what does this say about both candidates' characters?
All right. You just said something. We don't have enough time to go into depth on this, and I want to do it again, but I'll start it today. People are not holding him accountable. You suggested that. And I think there was Jim Ruttenberg, who writes media columns for The Times, wrote a piece this 2 days ago about how you cover a Donald Trump who has been shown over and over again to fabricate information, facts. Jim, Greg, what is the responsibility here? Do you just throw it out there without challenging and believe that voters are smart and they'll make their own decisions? I mean, you're covering this thing, Jim. You're following it too.
Right. And I got to say, I'm using a little bit harsher language today than I did last August when he was kind of considered a, when we all thought he was going to be going away by October. But am I using tougher language when I describe what he's done and especially how his decisions are impacting his campaign? I think I am.
But you're a columnist, right? I mean, I assume the AJC accepts the fact that you are going to write your opinion into the pieces that you publish, right?
Right, right.
Or at least more analysis, yeah. No, it's and this touched on a conversation that's happening throughout journalism circles is how can you still be objective but also call Donald Trump out for fabricating or for lying or for misstating or whatever, however you want to say it. And it's happening all the time. And yet he still gets the lion's share of the ink no matter what. You know, there was that famous statistic that showed he got $2 billion in free press. I'm sure it's $4 billion by now because he still drives traffic from either his lovers or his haters. And so there's that debate at the same time as, you know, are we over-covering Trump? At this point, I don't think there is such a thing as over-covering.
So, Andre, you have about 30 seconds on this one. In a funny way, I think the media holds Hillary Clinton up to more scrutiny than Donald Trump. Now, that doesn't mean Trump doesn't get more of the headlines, but most of his headlines are self-inflicted wounds. I don't know that the media is holding him accountable in the same way they are to, say, Hillary Clinton, because they already know that a lot of what he's saying isn't going to be accurate or necessarily truthful.
Well, I mean, I think part of the problem is a lot of what Trump says is actually really superficial, and so it's hard to kind of get into the substance unless it's completely outrageous. And so because Clinton has this 25-year history and because she's wonkish and so she's going to give more details, there's a little bit more meat to get into. So I think the question is how to present that
information. Look, Bill, we don't even know whether Donald Trump is truly a billionaire yet.
Right, right.
I mean, we don't know what to call it. That's the basis for his whole campaign. I've made lots of money.
We don't know that at the AJC. We now call him a businessman. We don't call him a billionaire anymore.
Interesting. All right. You got the last word, Greg Bluestein. Congratulations. We have a prize for you waiting at the door as you leave. We are completely out of time today. Andre Gillespie, I'm so glad you're back in
Atlanta
and here in the studio with us. Good luck at the start of a new school year.
Thank you.
Greg Bluestein, you know you're always welcome here. And Jim Galloway, without you, I don't know what we'd do on this show. So thank you all for a really great conversation today. Jenny Amond, our senior producer. Trevor Young, our producer. Hannah Rose Adams, she's getting set to go back to school fairly soon, so we're only going to have her around for another few days. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks again for joining us for Political Rewind. We will see you Friday at 3 o'clock when we'll have the executive director of the Georgia Democratic Party to talk about what she knows about what the Clinton campaign plans to do in Georgia. See you then.